Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Counted me out and said to drop out. But the American people... Well, the American people don't quit, and they deserve a president who doesn't quit either.
All right, all right, all right. Hillary is the comeback id, not the comeback kid as her husband was. The comeback id, I've named her today. Of course, you can steal that, as most of you do, steal most of my ideas for the internet and other radio shows. But she really is the comeback kid because it's about her. It's not about America, which is what the election is all about. It's all about them, not about us. Isn't that great? Now, the question is this. Would Hillary be tougher on our Islamo-fascist enemies than McCain? After all, Hillary has fire in the belly. McCain, I don't think, has much fire anywhere. Hillary is actually campaigning as though this is life and death for her. She has spoken out more strongly against Iran than John McCain. Listen. Listen. Listen, listen, listen. You see, I have a staff that you know what I love about my staff is that they're very sensitive to cues. You don't have to give them numbers or tell them to play something. All you got to do is give them a word, listen, and the next thing you know is you get a blank stare. Now, Obama wants to go back to eating his organic egg whites instead of eating those artery-busting meals on the campaign trail. Maureen Dowd of the New York Times wrote a very charming article, Waffling in Pennsylvania, which was actually quite good, about Obama seeming like a naughty child who was upset that he had a campaign. Why couldn't he just be president already? Meanwhile, Bush is acting like he has spring fever. And if you want to compare Bush's spring fever versus Hillary's spring lever, you could do so. What I mean by that is Hillary will pull the lever on anyone who stands in her way while Bush can't wait to get back to Texas to cut hay. I mean, here we had Bush making a joke of himself, almost like a deranged jokester in New Orleans, making no sense whatsoever, totally disconnected from reality, acting as though he has spring fever and he can't wait to get rid of his job already. You know, I don't blame him. While she really wants this job, which is amazing, frankly, that anybody would want this job. I don't know who would want this job, Hussein. I don't even know what's in it. And so I come back to the fact that I think Hillary is the comeback kid and comeback id, excuse me. And strangely enough, she seems to be tougher than McCain. Now, I don't know that she'd actually nuke Iran as she said she would. Do we have the clip ready or you're...
Whatever stage of development they might be in their nuclear weapons program in the next 10 years, during which they might foolishly consider launching an attack on Israel, we would be able to totally obliterate them. That's a terrible thing to say, but those people who run Iran need to understand that, because that perhaps will deter them from doing something that would be reckless, foolish, and tragic.
Well, there it is. She seems to be playing the Iron Lady, at least she did before Pennsylvania, and it worked for her. If you actually analyze what happened in Pennsylvania, it's very interesting. I'm not going to do what they do on television. Pennsylvania churchgoers turn their backs on Obama. Working class whites and gun owners choose Clinton. I mean, it's been said and analyzed to death. I wish I could tell you they chose them for various political reasons other than personality reasons. And I'm not sure that it wasn't all about personality. But she ran a tough campaign. And she did the right thing, if you want to talk about campaign. She finally got tough. She finally exposed Barry Hussein for who he is, and it worked for her. It's a little bit too late, frankly, in the campaign for that. But if Hillary had only understood that Barry Hussein is a questionable man to most Americans and had exploited that, she wouldn't be so far behind in the race. So, you know, the issue about Barry Hussein is an interesting one. I want to ask yourself, I want you people, particularly you liberals, ask yourself one question. And be honest with yourself. Don't call me. Just ask yourself this question. Ponder it tonight. Take two aspirin and get back to Doc Savage in the morning. Would an unknown junior senator from the Daily Machine in Chicago have gotten this far if he were a white man? Okay? It's all about race. Most particularly, white liberal guilt. That's where he's getting his support from. Why is there otherwise such almost fanatic worship here of this guy? What has he done? Did he cure polio? Did he cure cancer? What has he done? So therefore, if he's done nothing, and he's simply a charismatic speaker, which he is, don't take that away from him. He's got a fabulous basso voice, and he's blessed with great vocal cords and great genes. He's a phenomenal speaker. His politics are extremely out of touch with the mainstream of America. We all know that. He's a far-left radical. He always has been, and he hasn't changed the stripes, if you actually listen to what he says. And the only reason he's gotten this far is because white liberals are full of guilt and they want to see a person of color elected to the White House. That's the main reason. There's no policy reason. Well, yeah, excuse me, with the far left, there is a policy reason. But with the middle-of-the-road white liberal, they don't even understand what the policies are because otherwise they'd be voting for the woman they know, which is Hillary, the comeback id. Phone number here is 1-800-449-8255. Go to michaelsavage.com. There's a strange picture of the veteran actor Peter Falk. Aging Columbo star's erratic behavior sparks call to police. The 80-year-old former Columbo star looked dazed and confused as he walked near his Beverly Hills home. I suspect this occurred last night as the results were coming in from Pennsylvania. I suspect that Peter Falk had seen that Obama was losing, and he ran wild in the streets of Beverly Hills. Because this, to me, looks like a picture of the representation of far-left liberals in America yesterday. If you turned on the news, all you heard was that it's bad for the Democrat Party and Wolfie is genuflecting with that jerk Schneider.
Is it really bad for the Democrats for this to go on, Bill? Well, yes, Wolf. It's very bad for it to continue to go on. There is some evidence that the Democrat Party is starting to melt down a slight bit.
What they're saying is, Hillary, get out of the picture. We want our candidate to win. It's so naked, it's not even humorous. It's absurd, you know. Also, for your visual entertainment on this day after tomorrow, on the left side of my website, we have a picture of, you know, the famous picture of David, the Michelangelo statue of the great David. Someone sent me a picture of what David would look like after a visit to the United States and too many stops at fast food outlets. And Michelangelo's David returns to Florence looking like, well, take a look at it on MichaelSavage.com. So those are some of the topics. There's another topic that caught my eye this morning, and that is a lead story in today's New York Times, inmate count in U.S. dwarfs other nations. Listen to this. This really caught my attention. The United States has less than 5% of the world's population, but it has almost a quarter of the world's prisoners. I mean, what? What? Could you believe this? We have less than 5% of the world's overall population, but almost 25% of the world's prisoners. So we're not living in a police state? What would you call this? China, which is four times more populous than the United States, with 1.6 million people in prison. The United States has 2.3 million criminals behind bars, more than any other nation. Question. There's no question here. I know the reason, and I know what we have to do. Is it time to change the drug sentencing laws in the United States of America? I believe it's long overdue. Now, I didn't say legalize drugs. Savage did not say legalize drugs. Savage said decriminalize drug use. I would say increase the penalties for drug peddlers and decriminalize the drug penalties for use of drugs. And the reason I say it is because I happen to watch a lot of these cop programs, and I see these prisons, and they're filled with, as we see, millions of people. And most of them are in there for minor drug usage. Or let's say second or third time around. If they're addicted, that is a problem, but it's mainly a problem for them. Unless they're addicted and they're committing crimes, that's another story. But merely to put them in jail for drug usage, I think is a disastrous use of a disastrous misuse of precious jail space and disastrous misuse of of a person's life. It's a terrible waste of a life, incidentally. So again, let me go back to that main statistic before you just do a knee-jerk response. The United States, less than 5% of the world's population, almost 25% of the world's prisoners. What are you going to do about it? There's a third story. Rupert Murdoch, who I affectionately call Moloch, is trying to buy a third newspaper in New York City for $580 million. Now, how is that possible? How in the world can one man own three newspapers and two television stations in one city when it violates federal law on two levels? And what kind of federal law is it if a magnate of this kind can simply sue the government and say your laws are unfair because they're preventing me from becoming a monopoly in any city I want to become? Three topics on the Savage Nation. The phone number is 1-800-449-8255. Go on to michaelsavage.com. Take a look at Michelangelo and Peter Falk, and I'll be right back.
Savage.
So it's the day after. Hillary is officially now the comeback id, and Obama is officially the tofu messiah. I have not yet come up with a perfect name for John McCain, but those two are going to – those are good. The comeback id and the tofu messiah, those will stick. Well, at least the comeback id will stick. The tofu messiah will not be used by the mainstream media because they've elected him to Godhead, so I doubt that it'll get much play. United States, 5% of the world's population, 25% of the world's prison population. Is it time to decriminalize the use of drugs? And Moloch. Should the government stop Moloch Murdoch from dominating the entire U.S. media landscape? Do you understand the danger posed by Moloch's media monopolization? Yes or no? San Diego, Lee, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi, I just wanted to give you kudos. I think you are awesome. You talk about things that nobody else will dare talk about, and you're really waking up the political zombies of the United States of America, and I appreciate it. And I just wanted
Are you talking about the Moloch story, trying to own three newspapers and two TV stations in violation of federal law?
Yeah, I think that's disgusting. I just think he's disgusting.
Well, it's not disgusting. It's a violation of federal law, which is supposed to protect us against media monopolies. Now, the reason the others don't talk about it is simple. If you look at the top people in talk radio, several of them are owned by the News Corporation in one way or another. So they're compromised. And this is exactly why the man must be stopped, because they're compromised. They can't go against their boss, their paymaster. Consequently, how many other stories are they told or do they understand they can't talk about? That's why we can't have a media monopoly. It's dangerous for freedom of the press.
And can I just tell you one thing? I've canceled my cable subscription because I don't want to fund them anymore.
Well, that's your decision. I'm not encouraging or discouraging any kind of boycott because it could turn on me. Thanks for the call. Here's another story that I thought would it has no relationship to – I don't know if it does. It may or may not have anything to do with the election, but I'm going to read it to you cold. It came out today. Study says masturbation may prevent prostate cancer. Now, I don't know why it's not on my website. I sent it to the webmaster. I want to read you this article. Masturbation may prevent prostate cancer? Men who frequently masturbate appear to have a lower risk of developing prostate cancer, Australian researchers reported. I know many guys are smiling like crazy now. Guys are smiling in cars across the landscape of America saying, darn, I knew it! I knew it! Mary was wrong! Researchers from the Cancer Council of Victoria found that men who masturbated more than five times each week, were one-third less likely to develop the cancer. The study surveyed 1,000 men who developed cancer of the prostate and 1,250 men who did not, and all were between the ages of 20 and 50, according to a report on Monday on the gay and lesbian news site Planet Out. Now you're saying, well, wait a minute, it's the gay and lesbian. Doesn't mean that it's not a valid study. Researchers told the BBC last week that the prostate produces one of the fluids involved in ejaculation and that frequent masturbation appears to flush out carcinogens. Now, here's the punchline. This is crazy. Sexual intercourse may not have the same effect because it increases the risk of contracting an STD, which could raise the risk of cancer, the website reported. So I don't know what you make of this, but, you know, maybe Jocelyn Elders was ahead of her time. And if Hillary wins, she could bring back Jocelyn Elders, the queen of self-gratification, and she could become the Health and Human Services Secretary again. Do you remember Jocelyn elders. She got fired because she suggested that people practice self-gratification. Play the elders clip. We dug it up.
In regard to masturbation, I think that that is something that it's a part of human sexuality, and it is a part of something that perhaps should be taught.
Whoa. Remember what that caused in the 90s? My God. That didn't go over very well in most parts of America. San Francisco, New York, Austin, Texas, yes. Now, there's a connected story in some way that came out today, too, from Kinshasa in Africa. And again, I'm going to read you the headline cold. Penis theft panic hits African city. I'm not making this up. Listen, Kinshasa, police in Congo have arrested 13 suspected sorcerers accused of using black magic to steal or shrink men's penises after a wave of panic and attempted lynchings triggered by the alleged witchcraft. Reports of so-called penis snatching are not uncommon in West Africa, where belief in traditional religions and witchcraft remains widespread, and where ritual killings to obtain blood or body parts still occur. Now, let me pause right there and say to you, maybe we should bring in more members of this tribe to further diversify America. That would be the Democrat plan, because after all, they're not Christianized, and so they love ritual killings to obtain blood. They believe in the shrinking of a man's penis through witchcraft. And since we're uptight Judeo-Christians here in America, by and large, who were not ready to move on and such, maybe the only way to do it is to bring in, thousands of members of this tribe to further diversify America. And then we can have penis theft panic hitting Washington, D.C., is why I'm reading this article. Again, this should be up on my website by the end of the day. You think it's a huge joke? It's unbelievable to me. Purported victims claim that sorcerers simply touch them to make their genitals shrink or disappear in what some residents said was an attempt to extort cash with the promise of a cure. And then they lynch people for doing it. And then one guy says, I thought it was a joke, said a policeman, but when you try to tell the victims that their penises are still there, they tell you that it's become tiny or that they've become impotent. To that I tell them, how do you know if you haven't gone home and tried it? Some Kinshasa residents accuse a separatist sect from nearby Bas-Congo province of being behind the witchcraft and revenge for a recent government crackdown on its members. It's real. Just yesterday here, there was a man who was a victim. We saw what was left was tiny, said 29-year-old Alain Kalala, who sells phones near Kinshasa. Well, bring him into America.
Savage.
Anyway, there's now a controversy on the web about whether or not masturbation reduces the risk of prostate cancer. People are saying no such report could be found on bbc.co.uk. And the question of does masturbating protect men against developing prostate cancer? Nobody really knows the answer. Blah, 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 blah. So we really don't know what the truth is on this. But it did attract your attention. There's no question about it. Incidentally, here's an interesting fact. CBS News has recorded its worst ratings ever. You know, Katie Couric, we called her Katie Coran Couric for a long time. But here's the interesting part for me. The news program, CBS Evening News, attracted an average of only 5.4 million viewers for the week. I have a larger audience than CBS Evening News. Can you believe this? According to Talkers Magazine, I have 8 to 10 million a week. Think about it. I have 8 to 10 million listeners a week, which is probably at least double what they get on CBS Evening News, according to this. That's amazing. I don't feel it, though. I don't walk around saying, wow, I have a big audience. I don't understand. What do they do? I don't know. It just doesn't make sense to me. Well, I'm not really like in a studio with lights and people running around kissing my ego. I'm sort of alone in my own mind all of the time. And consequently, the show is more real. Because there is no, you know, stage set and people smiling across the glass. Sometimes I wish I had an old-style radio audience with 12 to, you know, 18 seats. But then you start playing to the audience. And that's interesting because, you know, who's the audience? You know, they laugh at everything you say to be nice to you and they're thrilled to be there. Does that mean you're smart and clever at everything you say? No. So it's an interesting one. I mean, I prefer playing to Teddy, my dog, who is usually asleep on the sofa next to me during the show. He's completely zonked out during the show. He gets up during breaks. He has an innate sense when the show is over. He knows when 3 hours are up. He starts to stretch. And he knows it. He just senses it. He knows it's that's amazing, whatever. That's all. So we got the Hillary thing. We got the Obama thing. We got the McCann thing. We got the drug thing. I think the drug story is good. 5% of the world's population, 25% of the world's prisoners. That should alarm anyone listening to the show. And that's why I suggested it's time to decriminalize the use of most drugs. And I would increase the penalties for drug peddling, and I would decriminalize the penalties for drug usage. To me, to see men, healthy young men in jail for possession of relatively small amounts of marijuana in particular, even though I'm totally opposed to the use of marijuana, from a medical standpoint, I think it's a disastrous drug. I don't think you have to put people in jail for using marijuana. I think it's insanity to do this. But, you know, you want to look at this from several different angles of why this is going on. You don't have to look any further than the fact that many prisons in America are privatized, and there's a huge profit motivation to see as many people pushed into the system as possible. So, you know, don't think there's no connection. You've got prison corporations that run prisons who are lobbying day and night to increase penalties for drug usage in order to increase business. You know, and when you have a country that's this out of control with no sanity, that's what you wind up with. So I have to take my hat off to the New York Times for reporting on this story. We have 5% of the world's population, 25% of the world's prisoners, and we say, wow, holy God, something's wrong here. Isn't it time to change? Yes, no, maybe. San Diego, Daniel, you're on the Savage Nation.
Yes, Michael, you might be interested in knowing that masturbation preventing prostate cancer has been in the medical literature for many years. And
so the old wives' tale that it leads to blindness is not true.
Well, you know, you might be able to conclude that. When I contacted bladder cancer, now the prostate is right below that. And I went to Google and I researched out all the credible medical websites like the Mayo Clinic and the Cleveland Clinic, Johns Hopkins. And you will see if you Google and get into these areas and just put in Google, masturbation prevents prostate cancer, Cleveland Clinic, Mayo Clinic, Johns Hopkins, University of Illinois, any one of those, and it will come up a ton of stuff on that. So it's been around for quite a bit, Michael.
Right. So you're agreeing that the articles in the mainstream literature actually support that contention?
I'll tell you, I'm in remission, so...
Wait a minute. Are you making a confession right now that had you only known that self-gratification of this nature was beneficial, you would have engaged in it more frequently, earlier on in your life?
Well, this came as a revelation to me.
I'm sorry. Look, I don't know. This is a wild topic for most men. Most men never talk about this, incidentally, Daniel. But what if it could be proven that there is a medical benefit to it? It's amazing what ramifications this would have. That could lead to a Nobel Prize in medicine for the publisher of Penthouse, Larry Flint. Instead of being reviled, he might get a Nobel Prize in medicine. That's a joke. It went over like, you know, you have to be quick-witted to really enjoy this show. If you're like, you know, an Obama voter, this isn't going to work for you. But I don't know. It makes sense in a certain way. A lot of men have very strong impulses in that direction, and I'm going to try to do this in a medical way rather than in a comedic, childish, adolescent way. There's a related bodily function that most people suppress in America because of our cultural mores, and that would be flatulence being kept in the body rather than released. I mean, it's for obvious reasons, you know. You don't want to insult everybody, but I mean, there are cultures where the buildup of flatulence is not considered an embarrassment when it's released. I wouldn't say people go out of their way, but okay. I have long felt for ages that people who hold in this kind of pressure in their body definitely are inducing damage to their colon and to the lower bowel. I really have felt that for a long time. Isn't it logical that a sulfurous gas that is pent up inside a tube is going to start to cause some kind of damage to that tube? I know this is like embarrassing to talk about, but it's more interesting to me than talking about Hillary and Obama. I would rather talk about a sulfurous gas building up inside a bodily tube than talk about these two gas bags. To be honest with you, I can't take it anymore. They never say a word about what they're going to do if they win. All we hear about is America doesn't like a quitter, and it's me again, and here I am again, day and night. So forgive me for talking about this, or penis theft in Africa, or Columbo running mad in the streets, allegedly erratic behavior. You got to see this picture of poor Peter Falk. I was wondering where he is. I used to like that guy. He had a great character on Columbo. I didn't even know if he was still living. They show the guy running like a nutcase in the streets of Beverly Hills with the shirt open and the belly hanging out. And to me, I would say the caption should be Obama loses in Pennsylvania, since most of them down there are libs in Beverly Hills. That I'll never figure out. They want more taxes? I mean, the people who have spent millions of dollars to figure out how to shelter their money. They hire the best tax accountants, and they've got every scheme in the world to avoid paying tax as much as they can. Their whole life is given over to avoiding paying taxes, and yet they want to elect a man who'll raise taxes by at least 15%. It doesn't make sense. There's only one answer to that question. Liberalism is a mental disorder. There's no other answer to it. Do you get this? Okay, 1-800-449-8255. Cincinnati, Ohio. Julia, welcome to the program.
Mr. Savage, I love you.
Oh, wow. At least somebody does.
But I tell you, your comment on Hillary Clinton, and I don't like Hillary Clinton, but your comment on her on peer in a pantsuit.
Ma'am, you're not coming in clearly. Please, your phone. My comment on Hillary is unfair because of why?
Because I think it was very derogatory towards women.
What comment? Calling her the comeback id?
No, sir. You said, I think your comment was Hillary, or you said that it was pair in a pantsuit, I believe you said.
Oh, yes, I was joking, and I said that it's getting so inane on television before the results. I said they're going to say that 99% of women who look like pairs who wear pantsuits voted for Hillary. So you took offense at that. Okay, I apologize. I apologize. It was more like 99.9%. You're right.
Okay, sir, I got to tell you, I know that you were joking, but to be honest with you, as you grow older as a woman...
I know. No, this is a sensitive topic. I was warned by a woman not to do that. But my comedic lust has no bounds.
You know what? If you apologize...
Look, I'm not perfect. If you took a look... What should I say? That guys who have a bit of a less than a David-like body voted for McCain? I mean, what are you going to say?
You know what? If you're not Hercules...
All right, get a better phone and call me back. I'm going deaf already from it, and a migraine. The right eye is out from this already. Here we are again. So we're talking about this, we're talking about that. There are some pretty big stories out there in addition to these, by the way. McCain is such a schmuck that he goes to Youngstown, Ohio, in front of a closed factory, and he says that NAFTA has been good for America. He's going to be Bush 3. I'm sorry, if you like Bush's policies, and I told you some of his policies are good, such as lower taxation and good Supreme Court justices. In that regard, there are some good things about the Bush administration. Let's not be foolish here. The guy himself may be a bit of a, let's say, a want there. But overall, I mean, the taxes have been maintained low, and there's some been disasters. We know that. So if you want Bush 3, vote for McCain, because he's a party platform. He's a party hack from the Republican Party. He goes to Youngstown, Ohio. McCain stands in front of a closed factory, and he starts telling a factory worker out of work that NAFTA is good. Play the clip.
I believe the overall result of NAFTA has been an increase in our economy, benefit to our country, and that debate needs to go on. I think the biggest problem...
All right, let's stop it. John, you're wrong. You're listening to the Republican Party. You're listening to the bartender who runs your campaign. You're committing Harry Caray. Listen to clip 3.
People in the know like to discourse about the new global economy. It's always global this and global that. But sometimes it seems that the map of the world they're using has only capitals, financial centers, and port cities.
In port cities? I didn't get that one. I guess he was trying to appeal to the guys in the Midwest there who don't have factories anymore. So these are interesting questions going on right now. 1-800-449-8255, michaelsavage.com. I'll be right back. Be here. Be nowhere. Savage. Inmate count in U.S. dwarfs other nations. 5% of the world's population, but almost a quarter of the world's prisoners. I mean, that should make you say something's wrong with this picture. Something is very wrong. We have 2.3 million criminals behind bars, more than any other nation. China, which is four times more populous, is second with 1.6 million people in prison. Now, that does not include, to be fair, hundreds of thousands of people held as political prisoners in re-education camps, which, of course, we'll have in America if Obama or Hillary win. Your corporation or your job place is a re-education camp today with diversity training. So that's our diversity. That's our re-education camps. So that's irrelevant in a way because it's hundreds of thousands. But the overall picture is an outrage for us. The only other major industrialized nation that even comes close to the U.S. in the terms of number of prisoners is Russia, with 627 prisoners for every 100,000 people. England's rate is 151 per 100,000. Germany's 88 per 100,000. Japan's is 63 per 100,000. We have a very high number of people in prison. And for what? You know that you're locked up in this country for many different things, but our approach to crime and punishment is the real issue. For example, writing bad checks, using drugs. Most other civilized countries would not give people prison sentences for those offenses. And I think we really need to stop putting so many people in prison. It's a disaster for this country. And I think American justice is a disaster for the world, incidentally. Chicago, Blake, welcome. You're on the Savage Nation. Your opinion, please.
Yeah, Dr. Savage, I'd like to say that the amount of money that is injected into the black market through the marijuana trade alone dwarfs all the income that's created through the other drugs. And I would say that if the laws were changed to make it so that the cultivation and growth of marijuana, for instance, would, if you made that legal, but you can still focus on going after the people who deal it, it would eliminate the income for the drug dealers, and it would also eliminate the amount of money that's made through the drug trade alone. And I think that would be...
Well, my position is along those lines. Increase penalties for drug peddling. Decriminalize penalties for most drug usage. Thanks for the call. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. Gary, WOR, New York City, what's on your mind? Go ahead, please.
Michael, thank you for taking my call. You're a breath of fresh air, a voice crying in the wilderness, a shaman, an absolute shaman. I thank God for you. Fasting.
As long as I'm not a shame, that's the main thing.
Right. You're not a shame. You're a shaman.
Gary, you know, I do try my best. I do try to bring novel ideas and novel phrases and sayings to keep the people listening. And apparently I'm making a little inroad here and there.
Well, where I can't help you with your financial troubles with this CARE organization, but when I fast and pray, I fast and pray for you. I thank God for you. You're a voice crying.
You know what? Prayer is very good, and lighting candles is very good. I don't have financial problems with CARE. Right now, because of about 20,000 donors, we're doing well. But I'm building up a gigantic fund because I'm going to take this all the way to the Supreme Court if need be. That's the point to remember. I'm not crying poverty here. The people who have been donating have been very generous, I got to tell you, Gary, but we're still waiting for the judge's ruling. It hasn't come down yet. I mean, I know what's coming, I suspect, and Clinton appointee in San Francisco in the federal court, I pretty much don't think she's going to side with me. She'd rather side with an Arab group like CAIR rather than with me. That's my guess, but we'll have to wait and see. Thanks for the call. Prayers mean a lot to me. They always have. I've always felt that they're one of the reasons that let me put it to you this way. I'll leave it go at that. I don't even want to finish the sentence. All I want to say is I believe in the spirit world. I believe in the supernatural world. I believe in God, and I believe in prayer. And I think that if millions of people are praying for you, or hundreds of thousands, or 10,000 people, it has an effect upon you in ways that you're not even aware of. You know, I mean, how do I prove that? I can't prove it. That's what belief is. Belief is something you can't prove. That's why it's called belief. If you look at the root word, belief. I believe it. That's when you can't know something for sure. You believe it. It's faith. And faith is very important to me, as I'm sure it is to many of you. I can be a rational person a good percentage of the day, and then there's a belief part of the day, a belief part of the being that there's no explaining. Let me give you an example. I knew a guy years ago in Hawaii. He was older than me. He was a professor when I was working for my degree. I loved him like a brother or a father. And then we lost touch with each other, and I moved here, and I had seen him only once in, God, 30 years. Only once. About 5 years ago, I saw him again. And about a week before my birthday, I said, I'm thinking of so-and-so. I wonder how so-and-so is. I'd like to get in touch with so-and-so. And I didn't. I didn't pursue it. I'm too busy. Yesterday, a call comes in from so-and-so's daughter that he died on exactly that day. My hair stood up. Now, this is not the first time I've had that happen. Very often when I start to think of someone who has been, someone who was either in my life but not currently, or someone who had been in my life but isn't, I know that something is going on with them. I have a very minor ability in this direction. It's a very minor one. Don't get me wrong. I'm not trying to play like I'm I have a very minor intuition in this area. I don't know where it comes from. But there are people who've developed this to a degree that's astonishing. But as someone who has studied this tangentially, I can tell you most of us have this to a certain extent. That's what makes us human. And that's why I'm opposed to using drugs, because I believe drugs kill these senses in us. I'm pretty sure they do. And in fact, I'm positive that a good percentage of nervous conditions, mental problems, fears, and whatnot are related to a suppression of these very intuitions, which are very much part of the human of the human condition, which should not be repressed or suppressed. It's a very, very disastrous part of our medical system that if a person shows any signs of having an intuitive sense of foreboding, it's medicalized as some kind of disease. The same way childbirth is seen as an illness rather than a blessing. They treat women who are giving birth as though they have a cancer that they have to get out of their body instead of delivering a miracle. The medical system's stupid.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Rock on the Savage Nation. The United States has less than 5% of the world's population, but almost 25% of the world's prisoners. They made the point already. We're talking about the election, Hillary, the comeback ID. For those of you who studied Freud in college, you'll get the joke. Obama is the tofu messiah. For those of you who eat tofu, you'll get the joke. McCain has not yet been named. I've affectionately been calling him the Tin Man for a few weeks, but it doesn't work. I'm trying to think of the correct moniker for him. I've got these guys nailed. I've been calling Obama the cardboard messiah for a few days, but I realize the tofu messiah is more appropriate because apparently the guy eats organic egg whites for breakfast every morning and did not like having to eat Philly cheesesteaks in Pennsylvania. Let me tell you something. If I had to eat one Philly cheesesteak in order to become president, I wouldn't even eat that one single Philly cheesesteak. Who in the world in this day and age would eat a steak with cheese on it and French fries unless they were suicidal? It's unbelievable to me. But look, old habits die very slowly. Welcome to the Savage Nation. If you want to talk about the prison system, if you want to talk about whatever, this is the place to do it. There are other topics. Murdoch taking on FCC media rule. Rupert Murdoch, as you well know, is the I would say he's the Hearst of our time. And if you saw the movie Citizen Kane, you'll know that's not a good thing. I mean, he may be a brilliant businessman, no question he is. Genius. Absolute genius. But monopoly is not genius. Monopoly is not good for freedom. Monopoly is not good for America. Monopoly is not good for freedom of speech or freedom of the press, no matter what your orientation is politically. How many times have I had to tell you that when the ex-Soviet Union was in its heyday, there were two newspapers, both run by the state. There was Pravda, the truth, and Izvestia. Both of them were published by state officials only. There was no private newspaper. So you say, well, what does that have to do with Murdoch? If you permit too much media control in the hands of any one individual, what you're doing is creating the equivalent of a state monopoly. What is the difference if one man runs this media monopoly or the state runs a media monopoly? It's still a monopoly. And it destroys the variety of ideas out there that should exist in a free market of ideas. You get it? WOR, New York City. Steve, go ahead, please.
Dr. Savage, I believe there is a conspiracy at the New York Post not to publicize your show. Because I've called the Post several times with news stories about you. They never print it. Now, you take the Daily News. I've been lucky. They don't always print every time I call, but three times I've gotten you in the Daily News. Once about the political zoo, once about you seeking funds for Go Against Care, and the other thing about you meeting with the movie people. Okay, I love you, Savage. You're a breath of fresh air.
You're like a PR agent, Steve. Stay on the line. But you're saying you don't get any luck at the Post. There's a couple of reasons. It's owned by Murdoch. He has competitors in the radio business who don't want any notice of me, obviously. But this goes to my point about monopoly. In other words, monopoly is at play here, is what you're saying.
Yeah, nobody Murdoch does? On the front cover, he puts American Idol constantly on the front cover. Is that news?
No.
I mean, come on.
We were warned when people in the entertainment business started buying newspapers that the newspapers would become appendages of the entertainment business, which is exactly what Murdoch is doing to the newspapers of our world. He bought the Wall Street Journal. He's already told them to shrink the stories, put sports on the front page. So that's good for the Wall Street Journal to turn it into a tabloid?
And now he wants to get Newsday, which I love. I used to love Newsday when as a kid growing up on Long Island. And now he wants that. It's the FCC, the Federal Trade Commission, whoever, has got to stop this. It's insanity.
Well, that's the problem. He's actually suing the Federal I think it's the FCC, in order to get around federal anti-monopoly laws. And the article is Murdoch taking on FCC media rule. And it's astonishing to me that the government would even entertain this.
It's insane.
Why would they grant a waiver to a man who wants to violate the rules that were put in place to protect freedom of speech? It doesn't make sense to me.
Born in the United States? I don't.
No, he's Australian, but he became an American citizen in order to get around that rule as well.
Yes, all they're concerned about who's going to win on American Idol. I mean, we got gas prices going up the gazoo, and we got this monopoly forming in New York, and no one cares.
Well, I mean, care. You care. Apparently, we're not the only ones in America who see that the Hearst of our day cannot be permitted to become a media monopoly. That's all. There's nothing against him personally. There are rules. There are rules, and there's laws, and it's to the betterment of freedom of speech. That's all. Steve, I got to tell you something. I didn't know that you're like a fan of mine who does this for me. Can I send you some kind of present? Would you like a hat? Would you like a Savage Nation hat or a cup?
Yes. And I also want to take you out to a pizzeria next time you're out on Long Island.
That's just what I need is a pizzeria on Long Island. No, what I need is a guy like you who listens to the show. Stay on the line, Steve. Get his address and send it on to you-know-who for a cup and a hat. That's all. Give him a cup. Give him a hat. Walk away cocktail. Whatever that means. They used to be on the wharf here in San Francisco. Go ahead. The guys would hawk the crab cocktails. Go ahead. Walk away cocktail. I don't eat crab. It tastes like metal to me. I stopped eating crab years ago. They taste like metallic because they're on the bottom. They're sucking the mud in. And they suck it in, and you're eating crab, and what you taste is like the heavy metals from the mud. I'm sorry. I know a lot of people in the seafood business aren't going to love me. I wouldn't eat that. I can't eat those poor guys. Those eyes, yeah. All right, forget it. It's the metallic taste on my tongue afterwards. I still have the ability to... Celebrity grizzly bear kills Hollywood trainer. A 700-pound grizzly bear attacked and killed a Canyon Country man at a compound near Big Bear Lake that trains wild animals for movies and television work. I saw this story last night when it came out. It's that show bear that they use that always is drooling and foaming. And the grizzly bear, which appeared in a recent Will Ferrell movie, killed a 39-year-old trainer with a bite to his neck. He had to be subdued with pepper spray. What's interesting to me is a 700-pound bear they could subdue with pepper spray, but not most of the people pulled over by cops who are out of control on PCP. A human being that weighs 200 pounds, for example, they usually can't even control him with pepper spray. How is that possible? I watch these wildest police chases, and sometimes I see these pursuits. I don't believe what some of the situations cops get into. It's hard to believe. I saw one what's the point? If you didn't see it, it wouldn't mean anything to you. The point is that here's a bear that's sprayed with pepper spray and he's subdued, but people can't be... I don't get that. But this story's neither here nor there. What's interesting here is that the stuntman was killed, but that the bear wasn't euthanized. And that's because the bear is worth more than the stuntman. Oh, that's a terrible thing to say. But you know the owner of the facility figured out that if they killed this bear, they would have lost big bucks because he already was a movie star. And the trainer they got out of... God knows, they could get another trainer from somewhere. It's not to say that the man who was killed should have been killed. That's not the same thing. But they found nothing unusual, blah, blah, blah. The department would take custody of the grizzly. No. He could not recall no other fatal bear attacks, blah, blah, blah. Nobody knows why. The bears, they say, can become agitated during training regimes that include repetitive actions. No kidding. You take a wild animal, you teach it over and over again to act like a dog, like a pet. And you don't expect occasionally one of them is going to kill you? Rocky says, Rocky and a grizzly named Dakota have worked on some of the wildest jobs ever done. They're world famous for wrestling scenes that have done in films and live shows. These bears are hardworking and known for long runs, great action, and stage attacks. They're good around people but can look extremely dangerous. Their website says Rocky is featured in a semi-pro bear wrestling scene, acting like a real fighter in the ring, with thousands of people cheering. Well, to be honest with you, I think there's a little animal cruelty here, you know? I mean, bears are notorious as being the most dangerous wild animals to work with. Why? Well, because they're wild animals, you know. But who's a wilder animal? Man is. The state used to be full of grizzlies. Now there are none. Now they're in a zoo with a collar on its neck. So I'm not saying the man should have been killed. It's a little different what I'm saying. You know, animals do not exist for our entertainment, okay? That's what it comes down to. To me, it's animal cruelty. Every time I see them being trained, it bothers me. I don't know. There's something in me I've always been like this. There's nothing, say I'm touched. I don't know what you... It's one thing to hunt for food. Let me put it to you that way. Hunting for sport is different than hunting for food. Training animals for movies, to me, is not exactly a noble profession. I'll be right back. Savage. We're talking about the inmates in America, how many there are, 5% of the world's population. We have 25% of the world's prison population. We're talking about Hillary as the comeback id, Obama as the tofu messiah. We're talking about Moloch marching on, that he wants to get around federal law, which prevents monopoly, and buy now Newsday. It's amazing that's what's going on in the world, and here's another story for you. China is down to 12 days worth of coal. You hear this? China only has enough coal for 12 days of consumption. Now, here's an interesting part to that story. 70% of all of the energy consumed in China is derived from coal burning. And I love it when you hear environmentalists, so-called, in this country screaming about how dirty this country is. When China is the biggest polluter on the planet, they have nothing to say about China, as usual, because it's only about hating America, really, not about energy consumption. But think about it. When you look back at World War II, Japan attacked us at Pearl Harbor to prevent the U.S. Pacific Fleet from stopping them from invading China. For what? They invaded China for the oil in Manchuria. And that was one of the reasons for World War II, was Japan's great industrialization, Japan's growth. Japan needed energy. Japan was a limited island. Japan needed the energy that they could steal from China. The only people to stop them were China's ally, the United States. So they attacked our fleet at Pearl Harbor to prevent us from preventing them from invading Manchuria, which they did, killed God knows how many Chinese people. Read the Rape of Nanking, and they took the oil out of Manchuria. Now, I'm very concerned that China, in its thirst for world dominance and for the increased industrialization, could go to war over energy. Can you imagine that? But we'll stick to some of the other topics right now. Baltimore, Maryland, Yehuda, on the Savage Nation. What's on your mind, please?
Happy Passover, Michael. Before I go on, I just wanted to commend you for your courage. That was really courageous of you to take on that the case with the Orthodox person praying on the plane. And you should know that you have so many Orthodox listeners. And
Wait a minute. So do you agree with me or disagree when I said that the Orthodox Jewish man who was removed from the plane should not have not listened to the flight attendant? Which side are you on?
You know, Michael, I had to hold my nose and agree with you because, you know what, that person should have asked the stewardess or the flight attendant before if it would be okay to stand there and then go ahead and pray.
Well, let me see if I understand this. His friends who are also Orthodox were not praying at that time. Does that mean that it's optional as to when a person prays?
Oh, well, I mean, there's no 2 minutes in a day where, boom, you have to pray, but there is a certain...
Oh, so in other words, he could have started the prayer after the plane took off.
He probably could have prayed earlier.
He could have prayed before. All right. No, I understand that. I happen to tell you, once I flew to Israel, it was a long time ago, and it was a gigantic 747. To me, they were all gigantic. And I'll never forget, as long as I lived, the plane took off from JFK, and I don't know when it was, but at some point, a group of Orthodox men got up and started to pray. I was moved by it. I thought it was phenomenal. Actually, it was the next morning, as light was breaking through the airplane, to see a group of men praying on the plane. I thought, if this is not a miracle, I'd like to know what is. A connection from the ancient and the modern. I never saw anything like it in my entire life. I thought it was wonderful. So don't get me wrong. I mean, I want the audience to understand I love prayer, and I really respect religious people. But when it comes to safety in the air, I'm sorry, you have to put that aside.
Absolutely. I totally agree with you on that. But there's one thing that you commented on the same day, and quite honestly, I wouldn't tell you this unless it's something to do with you, with your heritage. You said something about that religions are cults, and I totally agree with you on that. However, there's one, you know, your own heritage, which is the Jewish heritage.
Wait, hold on. Let me explain to you what I said so people know what I'm talking about. I said any religion that begins initially is a cult. And I said the difference between a cult and a religion is only the number of adherents. For example, Christianity was originally a cult of Judaism, wasn't it?
That's correct. That's absolutely correct. But how did Judaism originate? Michael, do you know how?
Well, hold on now. Give me a second. I mean, you came in with the question loaded and you fired. Give me a second to think. How did it originate? God spoke to Abraham. Isn't that how it originated?
No, that's how it originated totally from the beginning. But that's not when the Jews became a nation. The Jews became a nation when God spoke to not one, but to 3 million people on Mount Sinai. And since then, that's when God said, you will be my chosen nation. You will be my nation as long as you keep, and you shall keep my laws. And you will be my, as it says, the kingdom of priests and a light unto the nations. And since then, there is nothing that could dispute Judaism except for God coming to the world, to 3 million people, and telling them that Judaism is not a religion. It's not a valid religion anymore.
Wait, I didn't say Judaism's a cult. My statement was different. I said that it's a difference between a cult and a religion is the number of adherents. I want to make that very clear. So I don't think that what you just said is in opposition to what I just said, is it?
Right. You're right. You're absolutely right. But I think that there is so much, Michael, you are a man of truth, and you're a person who looks for the truth, who seeks the truth, and who loves the truth. And I think if you would know more about your heritage, you would adhere to it like nothing before.
And I appreciate it, but you have no idea how many people think I would adhere to other heritages if I understood it better. And that's why I tend not to get into a religious talk in that sense. I'd rather read the Old Testament and leave it at that, Yehuda. But I want to wish you and your family and everyone you know a wonderful Passover. I really do. And I thank you for calling the Savage Nation. The time is 28 minutes after the hour. You're listening to the one and only Savage Nation, a voice unto itself, a show unto itself, a sound unto itself, because there is nothing like it. And the fact of the matter is, that's wonderful. We're all unique. We're all like snowflakes. No two people are exactly alike. And I thank you for listening. And with God's will, I'll be back after the break. So listen.
Savage.
This is my favorite time segment of every hour, because at 34 after the hour, coming out of that mid-hour break, it's a long one. It's very fluid. There's no hard stop set. And I generally can relax a little bit more and develop an idea. So one of the things I wanted to mention was I called Obama a tofu messiah. Okay, fine. But speaking of tofu, for lunch, I made a tofu burger. I don't know why. I haven't had one in years. I don't generally like a soybean. I used to eat it a lot when I was younger, before I knew any better. But I don't particularly care for beans in general. I don't do. My body's not made for digesting bean products. I don't know. Some people are. Some aren't. I don't have the enzymes for beans. So I ate the tofu burger. It was so horrible. It was so horrible. You start to weigh whether you're better off with a hamburger and clogging your arteries or dying of boredom from eating a tofu burger. It tasted absolutely like eating straw. It was horrendous. Thank God there was ketchup. This is my, thank God that you can put ketchup on a thing like that. So tonight I'm going to have to actually eat dinner somewhere. That was awful. Every time I cheat myself by doing like a quick, like, it never works out for me. I wind up like gorging at the next meal. That's like neither here nor there. We're talking about serious stuff, bears, and Hillary, and Obama, and McCain, but I have enough of it already. How much can you take of this already? It's over already. Leave us alone with Indiana. But it's one last point. Maybe it won't be the last, but you look at the New York Times, sometimes the articles in there are so good, it can make you weep because it reminds me of the old New York Times, which I grew up on. Some of the articles are amazing. Inmate count in U.S. dwarfs other nations. It's an excellent article. But then you see the propaganda in the middle. Here, Hillary beats Hussein in Pennsylvania, which is a huge victory. It's the turning point of the campaign. And I predict she's going to win, by the way, by hook or by crook. I'll go back to that at another time. And what do they show? The headline is so obtuse you can't figure it out. It says Clinton takes duel with Obama in Pennsylvania. Now, what does that mean? Instead of Clinton beats Obama in Pennsylvania, they twist it and they say Clinton takes duel with Obama in Pennsylvania. What do you mean takes duel? What are they talking about? And then they show a picture with Obama on top eating a cheesesteak, again with his arrogant look, looking up. He's always looking up and looking down at people, and she's underneath him. And then they say the bruising will go on for the party, too. All they're concerned about is the party. The party, the party, the party. And that's the problem with America, is the party. The parties have been having too much of a party at our expense. You understand that or not? That's how propaganda works. So my job is to analyze these things for you. Now I'm going to take your calls. We're going to go first east, then across the country to the west. Right now we're going to WOR. Matt, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Michael, several months ago, you were talking about a restaurant you were at, and you had scongeli on the pasta, and you
yes.
were saying how hard it is to find good scongeli.
Yes.
So I wanted to tell you, I was in the Bronx today at Arthur Avenue shopping for a bunch of niceties because I'm making my wife dinner tomorrow night for her birthday.
Wow.
And two little seafood stores, and they both had fresh scongeli.
That's and very unusual on the – see, that's – I would say it's more usual on the East Coast. But on the West Coast, they don't even know what scongeli is, by and large.
Hard to find it. Now, I wanted to ask you for a recommendation.
I did find it, and this is the odd part, Matt. It's a sea snail, incidentally, scongeli. You know that, right?
Yeah, I do.
Okay. Now, I can't say I love it that much. I happen to like calamari much better since I had it. Truthfully, I prefer calamari, but we'll put that aside for the minute. It's my own likes. I could never find scongeli in San Francisco. I never found it. I couldn't find it in L.A. In most of the Italian restaurants I've eaten in, some of them are excellent restaurants. I was in Beverly. I really shouldn't give away where it is. Let's say it was not in Beverly Hills, but there's a restaurant, an Italian restaurant that's above the hills of Beverly Hills, in the middle of nowhere, they have Scungili. So I said to the owner, how the heck in this shopping center could you have Scungili? He said, my father was from New Jersey. We're from New Jersey. So I said, don't say anymore, please. I'd rather be able to come back here. I don't want to wind up in a... But they have Scungili. And by the way, their sauce is incredible. Well, I raved about it.
I'm making.
So what else did you find?
Oh, I got some beautiful veal cutlets. I got some beautiful little tuna from Medley. I got scormorza cheese. I got veal and pork to make meatballs.
Why is it that in the Italian tradition the man cooks and it's not considered like feminine? You know, feminine. I mean, it's true in the Italian. It's true in the Russian tradition. I don't know where it's not true. I think in most cultures, there are some that a man would not cook at all, ever. It would be considered feminizing. But it's not certainly feminizing when the Italian men will cook, the Russian men will cook. Where did this come from, do you think?
Well, I think the man went out and he brought home the animal and, you know, he put it to the fire and he fed his clan. That's where it came from. It's a very soothing thing to be in the kitchen and spend a day there cooking.
I don't mind it. I enjoy it. I find it's more relaxing for me than almost anything else I do. I don't do it enough. When the children were home, I would do it because it was fun to have, you know, a little crowd to cook for. But it's not that much fun when you're not cooking for a group of people. I guess I'm a frustrated restaurant owner or cook or something. Who knows? No, but it is fun being behind. There's something very satisfying about cooking to me. But cooking has to be done almost the way I approach like anything else. It has to be organized, Matt. For me to enjoy cooking, every ingredient has to be thought out, lined up, put out, chopped in advance. Then it's a pleasure. But if it's a helter-skelter thing, it's absolutely unenjoyable. You agree with that?
Absolutely. As the French say, mise en place. Get your stuff in order, right?
I didn't know that, but I know myself, with my background in science, I like everything lined up like in a laboratory experiment. In other words, if I'm going to use a certain amount of chopped onion, I want the onion chopped in advance. By me, it's okay. I need it all there, ready to go. Otherwise, you get distracted and it becomes so hectic, you don't know what you're doing. So that's a nice meal. It's just you and your wife?
No, I have 7 children. I've got 18 grand, 18.
Oh, my God. So you have an entire tribe there.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I have, there'll be 35 people in my house for dinner tomorrow.
Oh, my God. Are you a lucky? You know, you want to know what a blessing is, Matt? You just said what a blessing is.
Absolutely.
You know that, though. I mean, you're the one who made it happen, right?
Yes, sir. That's correct.
How many children? You have 7 children?
Sure. My brother has 6. My other brother has 6. My sister has 6. And I got 3 other sisters that have 3, 2, and 1.
Unbelievable. Well, blessings to you, my friend. I thank you for calling the show. That is a blessing. Now we're going to go on to a political topic that I have not touched on, but it's a very important one. We're going to go to Aaron in Washington, D.C., who has a piece of news that I've known about, but I've not yet discussed. Aaron, welcome to the program.
Yes, Mr. Savage, I'm currently a student in high school. And I've always been a supporter of Israel's policy of strength through action, but I was just wondering what your predictions are for the rest of the Al-Mardin administration and the issue with the Golan Heights in Syria.
I saw this morning, Israel ready to return Golan Heights to Syria, ? Israel's prime minister, I call him the Benedict Arnold, Ehud Olmert, has told Syrian dictator Bashar Assad that Israel is willing to give up all the Golan Heights for peace with Syria. I think that if Olmert has not learned that giving up Gaza has resulted in rocket attacks upon cities in Israel, Olmert should be arrested immediately and put into a mental hospital or a prison. Does that answer your question?
Yes, and just one more thing.
But let me qualify what I just said. If I believed that giving up the Golan Heights would bring about peace in the Middle East, I'd be all for it. But I'm a realist. I'm not a dreamer. And all I can tell you is that the example of giving up a tiny strip of land called Gaza resulted in exactly what I knew would happen when it was being done. I said it on this show. I said, are they insane? They're not going to get peace from the Palestinians. They're going to use it as an advantage, a toehold closer to Israel. It was logic to me. Logic and history are irrefutable. And logic and history tell us that if this traitor, Olmert, does what Condoleezza Rice and that dunce George Bush want this puppet to do, give back the Golan Heights to Syria, Israel will be destroyed.
I agree, absolutely. And do you think that Israel will ever return back to the days of, say, Benjamin Netanyahu, when they wouldn't really take any aggression off of anybody else in the Middle East and were definitely willing to...
You mean back to the Moshe Dayan Golda Meir days?
Yes.
I doubt it. I think that Israel is on the road to self-suicide, or suicide. And there are many factors, not the least of which is time, exhaustion, corruption, decadence. The very things that are affecting the West in general are affecting our dear friends in Israel, the canary in the mine shaft. And the canary in the mine shaft is dying from the gas leaking out of the Middle East. And that's a very sad fact of reality. There are other factors in Israel that are never discussed, Aaron. And I have to tell you that my feeling that the large number of Russians that came into Israel were overall not good for the survival of Israel. Do you agree or disagree with that?
Yes, I agree. Absolutely. A lot of them were, had mafia connections. And,
I believe that the corruption in Israel is directly connected to the influx of too many refugees from Russia, many of whom were not even Jewish, but they were pretending to be Jewish in order to make Aliyah into Israel. And they brought with them the very same criminality that they left behind in Russia, or that had them thrown out of Russia. And overall, it's not been very good. That's not to say that all Russians are criminals, don't get me wrong, or that all Russian emigres to Israel have been negative. I'm just telling you there's a factor here that no one ever talks about, and that's a fact of reality. But that's not the only reason Israel's going under. You have generations of kids, a whole generation of kids who have been raised not to fight, not to hit back. They've been poisoned by liberalism the way America's youth is being poisoned by liberalism. And as a result, Israel's unable to defend itself in some regard. I don't know what the end result is here. I don't know how this plays out. If you have two different schools, one next to the other, and in one school they're being taught to kill, to murder, and their coloring books are filled with the enemy, and the enemy is shown to be the descendants not of humans but of apes and pigs, and in the other school the children are taught that all human beings are sacred and all human beings are good and everybody's a friend and let's all get along, tell me who wins the fight.
It's going to be the one that is taught to kill and fight back. Absolutely.
I'm sorry to tell you that's a reality of reality. Thanks for the call. I'll be right back.
Savage.
The hour flies away from us. I'll tell you that that espresso, I haven't had espresso since I had pneumonia and got over it. I think I'm over it, but I stopped having the afternoon espresso. I took one today before the show. I got to tell you, it helps. I put a little piece of lemon in it, Italian style. I understand why that's done. And I drank water afterwards, as I do with all coffee, Arab style. That's very intelligent, since coffee is coffee's a diuretic. Adding water after coffee is very smart. And the Arabs, who of course brought coffee to the West, know more about it than anybody on earth. Cafe Arabica, after all, did come from Ethiopia. But having said all of that, boy, that really works. See, to me, there's no such thing as a simple anything. If I have a simple thing like a coffee, I'm thinking about the origin of the bean, who brought it to the world, which cultures look at it. It's really beautiful. I mean, having a mind that operates like this can be a burden to some people. To me, it's a pleasure. It's why I love radio. It's the one place I get to really exercise this organ between my ears. This is a wonderful thing, radio. There's no other medium like it. Writing isn't like it. I got to tell you, television is certainly more constrained than radio. Radio's the wild west of the media, incidentally, which is why it's not going to last much longer. In this button-down world with these two parties pulling the numbers they're pulling on us, hating the people, knowing that we're the only thing that stands between them and really raping the Treasury, you know, with the monopolies that are brewing here, you better enjoy this, because this is the last gasp of freedom of speech in the United States of America. And I swear to you, I see that coming. And it's coming faster from the Republicans, or let's say as fast from the so-called Republicans as the Democrats. Look what they were talking about, that Trent Lott thing, that Trent Lott creature. You remember him, the dear friend of talk radio, what he said? I haven't forgotten any of them. I saw where it was coming from. I never trusted any of these phonies. Albany, New York, Zach, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hi, Mr. Savage.
Yes.
I'll try to make this really brief. I just wanted to say thank you for your books and your radio show helping kind of change my life.
How so? Yeah. How did I change your life, sir?
Well, when I was younger, I had the stereotypical English stepmother, if you will. And I came from kind of an abusive family, so I started growing up a really angry liberal without really knowing why. I just had a big chip on my shoulder. I was really angry at everything. I blamed the country. I blamed the man. I blamed everything, you know?
Uh-huh.
And I eventually started kind of wondering why I was miserable in life and started wanting to straighten my life out and ran into a friend of mine I hadn't seen in years who was kind of doing the same thing, and he exposed me to your show, and I started listening to your radio show. And it made a lot of sense. And
I hope you have not become a Republican as a result.
No, I'm just
okay, because I don't want to be responsible for that.
No, I'm just not a crazy, whacked out, angry liberal that just hates America.
All right. Well, as long as you could reach the point of, let's say, being open-minded and independent, that's another story. Because you know, the danger here is the party system, not any particular party. They're both in it for their own party. They're not necessarily in it for America. Where the interests of America and the party overlap, they'll say fine. But when the interests of the party and the interests of America don't overlap, I can guarantee I know which one's going to win.
Yeah. Well, I don't even want to say, like, I don't even mean I was a liberal as a party. I was, but as a mindset, I didn't even know anything about politics back then.
Yeah, I understood. So you're saying it's an uptight, Protestant, puritanical nation, and if it was only a little more light and, you know, it was more loose, you'd be happier. That was your upbringing.
I was just crazy and angry, and I blamed all.
Yeah, but how, you're a young guy, Zach. How old are you now?
I'm 29 next month, sir.
Yeah, all right. So you'll liably become an angry conservative, you know. Don't assume your anger is going to go away just because you're open-minded. You're liable to first become angry.
Now that I've let those chips on my shoulder go, I'm a lot happier.
Well, wait a minute now. Now that the chips on your shoulder have left your body, you might really have cause for anger now. It may not be emotional. It may be rational.
But when I read your
Hey, Rick, I want to say thanks. I really do. What did this here, West Palm Beach, my old listeners on WFTL are back now that they're not listening to a Women's Tiddlywinks. Welcome to the program, Brian. What's on your mind?
Why not Hillary?
Go, talk.
What's on my mind? What's that?
I didn't know what you mean. What do you mean, why not Hillary?
Why not vote for Hillary? I'm ultra-conservative. I've always voted Republican my whole life. But now things are changing and things aren't, you know, things are just not going well for the states. Why not try something different?
Well, I think that you work for the Democrat Party, and that's okay for you to work for Hillary. It doesn't bother me. Hillary's speech that she'd be tougher on Iran, for example, than McCain struck me as very interesting. But I don't know that she means it. Because a year before, she said the exact opposite. So how do we know which Hillary we're going to get?
Oh, that's right. We don't know. But how do we know, you know, we're not going to follow another Bush with McCain? You know, what are we going to do?
Well, the argument for McCain over Hillary at this point, to me, comes down to taxes and Supreme Court and judges. You put everything else aside, taxes and judges alone would have me vote for McCain, Brian. You know that Hillary would appoint someone like Bill Clinton to the Supreme Court as sure as I'm sitting here. Or one of the other hacks that used to be her flax would wind up on the Supreme Court. Can you imagine that?
Man, I can imagine that. Yes, I agree.
You remember some of those whacked out lawyer hacks that were always appearing on television? What is to prevent her from making one of those people into a judge? You know, she hasn't changed really that much. In some regard, she has. She's become a very wealthy woman. Over the years, her husband earned over $100 million. God bless him. It was all legal. And there's nothing like a reformed liberal who's now a multimillionaire to come to their senses with regard to taxation. So the day she'd come out and say, you know what, I've rethought it. I'm not going to raise taxes. I might vote for her. But I haven't heard her say that, Brian.
True. But let me bring something else to light. And I do not work for her just by saying this. You know, I got a fiance from Germany. How do we know? I mean, she won't become the next Angela Merkel. I mean, she could become fantastic. People love her all through the country. You know, what's to say that we need, you know.
But how do we know she won't become Evita Peron?
We don't know that. You're exactly right. That's why your opinion counts to us. And I wanted to say before when I first got on the air here with you that we love you here in West Palm Beach. We think you have more game than the Parker brothers. We absolutely love you.
Yeah, well, tell a local affiliate the same thing. I would appreciate it so they could stop playing women's tiddlywinks before my show. God bless them. I love that affiliation. Hey, look, I'll be back for another big hour. Be here.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
Is the Savage Nation. Many topics. 1-800-449-8255. Phone number, but don't call. It was sold out. The website's at michaelsavage.com. Let's go to the callers because I think the callers right now will bring us up to speed. I don't know where to begin because the callers, truthfully, are so great. Let's start with KNEW. Dimitri, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Dr. Savage, thank you so much for taking my call. As much as I admire you as a person, talk show host, there are some topics that I have to disagree with you with all due respect. Being an Israeli citizen, I was really concerned when some time ago you mentioned that, in your opinion, Palestinians should have their own state. But before we get there, with your permission, I would like to add some comments about the Russian-speaking population in Israel, because I was born in Russia. Russian is my native language, and I know the topic from the inside. I've been to the Israeli army, and, you know, my entire platoon was Russian-speaking. And in my honest opinion, you know, Russian population in Israel is probably Israel's only hope right now, because, you know, native Israelis, they betrayed their country, in my opinion. That's how I see it.
Well, all right. So you're telling me a different picture. You're giving us a different picture. So you take umbrage with my statements of a while ago that it's inevitable that there will be a Palestinian state, is what you're saying.
Well, I understood that you were sort of in favor of this idea, you know, for the Palestinians to have...
I was in favor of it, but after the Gaza experiment, I'm not in favor of it. It would be suicide for the creation to see a creation of a Palestinian state. It's not a group of people that want peace. They want the disappearance of Israel. And there's two factions of the Palestinians. You've got one faction that's upfront about wanting to kill the Jews and drive them out of the Middle East, and that's Hamas. And then you've got the others who cry crocodile tears and pretend they want peace, and that's the Fatah group. And the end result here will be the disappearance of Israel entirely. But where does that leave us? What are you going to do with millions of Palestinian people who are disenfranchised? What would your solution be, Dimitri?
Well, if you ask my personal opinion, I would stick to Rav Meir Kahane's idea of transfer. I think this is the only viable...
I'm sorry, say that again, the idea of what?
There was, once upon a time, there was a great Zionist, religious Zionist, Rabbi Meir Kahane, who was killed
Okay, I remember him. He was killed in New York. I remember the day, because I was not too far away just by chance. It was an astonishing coincidence. And what was his proposal?
He proposed a total transfer of all the Arabs in Eretz Israel to Jordan or any other Arab countries. After all, there are about 22 of them, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, Jordan is a majority Palestinian population. Is that correct?
75%.
Yes. And one side note that listeners should know, more Palestinians were killed by Jordanians in the Black September uprising of 1970 than in all of the wars with Israel. You know that to be a fact as well.
Absolutely. Thank you.
That's when the Palestinians who had been made guests of Jordan try to take over the country. The Jordanian military rebuffed that attempt and killed more Palestinians in the Black September uprising of 1970 than had ever been killed in all of the years of wars with Israel, per se. But that's a side note. I've heard the argument that the issue should not be the West Bank, but the East Bank. And the East Bank of the Jordan River happens to be Jordan. And there have been arguments made over the years that that's a more natural place for a Palestinian state. The problem is that the Palestinians are as tied to their land and their ancient connections to the land and their olive groves and their orchards as are the Israelis who have been there for generations. Now, you can't uproot people and say, go to Jordan and they're going to be happy, Dimitri.
I'm afraid the reason behind their will to stay in Israel is a little different. The thing is that no Arab country doesn't want Palestinians among them, because no matter where these guys go, they cause trouble. Look at Lebanon. Look at Jordan, as you just mentioned. Look at Iraq and, Desert Storm, the liberation of...
Kuwait.
Thank you so much, sir.
Dimitri, I understand, but I don't have an answer anymore. For a while, I thought the only solution would be a two-state solution. But after the giving back of Gaza, which I was opposed because I said the general is crazy. He was one of my heroes, incidentally, the great Israeli general, for his actions in encircling the Egyptian Fifth Army. On the other side of the Suez Canal was one of the great feats of military history, as far as I'm concerned. And by the way, the treatment of the Egyptians after capturing them was quite noble, incidentally. They didn't kill any of them. In fact, the Israelis flew in water for the Egyptians. It was one of the most brilliant things in war history, because instead of engendering hatred for generations, it engendered peace for at least a generation. But having said that, when I woke up to the general saying we're going to give back Gaza, I said the man has lost his mind. Something's wrong here. And true enough, what has happened is a tragedy. It's a tragedy primarily for the Israelis who are being hit by rockets every day. And if the Israelis are getting hit by rockets every day just from this little strip of land called Gaza, what would happen if a Palestinian state originated? It would be the end of Israel. It would be a nuclear war.
Absolutely.
So, Dimitri, which brigade did you fight in?
I beg your pardon, sir?
Your brigade that you fought with in the IDF, did it have a name?
I actually never been to a real battle. I was just doing my time in the Israeli army.
Putting you on the spot. It's just that I know the names of some of the more commando-like brigades, which are never seen and never shown. And that's a darn shame. And that's a real tragedy for the state of Israel to hide their bravest Samsons, as far as I'm concerned. The same way our Samsons and our Solomons are hidden by the rats and the others in the media. When have they ever shown, let's say, a noble special forces group? When do they show the faces of these men of the Green Berets? Instead, they're showing the poor men who come back wounded. And they pretend, by the way, the media, that they're doing it because they have sympathy for the military. When they don't, what they're really doing is undermining the militant spirit of American young men. That's the real meaning for showing guys without arms and legs. It's not because they have any sympathy for the military. These atheists and these communists in the media are simply trying to undermine the desire to fight for America. And it's the same with Israel. When has Israel last shown the heroes that fought in Lebanon against Hezbollah? And the only reason they lost in the battle against Hezbollah is because not only was one hand tied behind their back, but two arms and one leg was tied behind their back. They didn't even use their air force to any extent against Hezbollah, and because they're afraid of the so-called collateral damage. If we had the same mentality, you'd be speaking German or you'd be a lampshade, and Germany would be ruling the world. This is the Savage Nation. Up next is Duncan Hunter. That's Congressman Duncan Hunter. And the reason I interviewed him is because he's going to give us, and it's the only interview I've seen or heard, on the update on the U.S. Air Force tanker deal. Remember, Boeing bid for this contract to build our tankers. We woke up and found out that Airbus got the deal. It was alleged that John McCain had lobbied for Airbus. I have still never gotten a satisfactory answer on that question. As you well know, John McCain thinks he's doing well, and that is why he does not want to meet the Savage Nation. That is his decision. It's his freedom. I still have a lingering question about the tanker deal. Perhaps Duncan Hunter will answer some of these questions for you in the next few minutes, and I suggest you stay tuned for that. on the tanker deal right here on the Savage Nation. I'll be back.
Savage.
Remember the scandal of the replacement of our tanker fleet? Remember that one? I told you about the contract to replace our Air Force fleet of tankers having been awarded to the European company Airbus, not to Boeing. Representative Duncan Hunter is here to tell us about what's currently going on with this deal and his attempts to stop it. Congressman Hunter, welcome back to the Savage Nation.
Hey, Michael. Listen, thanks a lot for having me here again. Appreciate it.
Tell us about this so-called deal.
This deal is a stimulus package for Europe. It'll send 100,000 jobs to European nations, which right now are refusing to give us an additional 100 troops per country for the operations in Afghanistan. So while we're sending 3,200 Marines over to Afghanistan because we can't prod our NATO allies into ponying up with just 100 people apiece for those 26 nations, we're on the verge of sending them probably the biggest defense contract in history. I'm going to do everything that I can on the Armed Services Committee to make sure that we don't go through with this deal and that we build a tanker in the United States. And incidentally, the 777 tanker, with the 777 made by Boeing, is by far a superior tanker to what the Europeans have come up with the Airbus version. The 777 has 2,000 miles more range, and it offloads about twice as much fuel at good distances. So it's by far the superior bird, and I'm going to do everything I can working on the Armed Services Committee to make sure Americans build this tanker.
How did this happen?
Well, this is a result of the Europeans who aren't ponying up on national defense and who are spending less than 2% of GDP on defense coming in to try to get good pieces of the American defense contracts. And you know, to some degree, Boeing has been outsourcing subcomponent work itself. I've had a tough time trying to get Boeing to buy American titanium and other American components for their airplanes. And this is a case of the outsourcer, Boeing, being outsourced themselves. So the leadership at Boeing deserves to get a couple of whacks now and then, but it's not right to punish the hundreds of thousands of workers who will see their work diminished by sending this tanker contract to Europe.
I've heard some say most of the work was to be done by U.S. companies.
Well, 58, according to Northrop, which is Airbus's partner in the United States, 58% of the plane will be built in the U.S., 42% will be built in Europe. If we buy the Boeing product, it'll be 85% in the United States. That amounts to a little over 12,000 direct jobs, according to Airbus itself, that will be in Europe rather than in the United States. And if you put a multiplier on that, because you have you support a fairly large community with manufacturing jobs, you're looking at a net impact of about 100,000 jobs. That's a pretty good stimulus package for Europe, for the United States taxpayers to be paying for.
What can we do to show our anger over this decision?
You know, I think this is one of those classic cases when you call your congressman, because we're going to be fighting this thing out legislatively. And if you let your congressman know that as long as American taxpayers are footing the bill for the defense of the free world, and you know the average American worker pays $1,000 a year out of his or her paycheck for the defense function of government, and we basically defend the entire free world. And as long as American taxpayers are paying for the defense of the free world, we ought to be making the components and the equipment that we're paying for. Call your congressman. This is one of those classic cases.
Well, where does it go from here?
Well, we're going to try to do what we can in the Armed Services Committee. Those of us who are supportive of buying American with our defense projects, we're going to do what we can to try to turn this thing around in the Armed Services Committee. And I know the Defense Appropriations Subcommittee in the U.S. Congress will also be working on this issue. But this is a matter of the American people letting their representatives and their senators know how they feel about this thing. If you call up your senator or representative, tell them you want to make sure that this tanker is made in America, then that'll have an impact on the legislative process.
Are we going to be able to turn this around?
You know, I hope so, because we pushed tons of defense jobs out of this country already. I think we've got a good chance of turning it around for three reasons. One, it's important to maintain the industrial base of this country. You know, a couple of years ago when I tried to find high-grade armor steel plate made in America, to put on the sides of our Humvees to protect against roadside bombs. I could only find one company left that could still do it. So maintaining the industrial base of this country that's capable of defending us in time of war is important. That's why it's important to get these defense contracts to American contractors. Secondly, simply buying the best plane is important. And the Boeing 777 is clearly superior to the A330 Airbus. It's beaten it in competitions around the world. That's why there's 1,000 of them on order right now. It's got much better range, and it's got much better carriage capability. So for those two reasons, I think the American taxpayers have a reason to call a representative and make sure that we win this.
It just seems inherently wrong to send our national defense contracts to foreign-owned companies.
You know what's interesting here is that we can't get our NATO allies to spend 2% of their gross domestic product on defense. That's a target for all the NATO allies. They'd much rather spend their money on social programs and then let Uncle Sam defend the free world. Let us go after the terrorists. So there's only one or two countries of the 26 NATO nations that spend 2% of its gross domestic product on defense. We spend more than twice that much on gross domestic product. And so we're a little bit like the guy who always shows up at the potluck dinners with the T-bone steaks and his brother-in-law comes in with the plastic forks. Europe is clearly not holding up their share of the burden in Iraq or Afghanistan, with a few exceptions. But clearly, we need to spur our European allies to spend money on defense and grow their own defense industry. And American taxpayers who pay for the defense of the free world should be building the equipment for the United States.
How can we, the people, change how things are done on a global scale?
You need to call your congressman or your senator once again and tell them that when they buy defense equipment, this isn't like making a personal choice to buy a Toyota instead of a Chevy. American workers pay for the defense of the free world. So when we buy defense equipment, the people who pay for it ought to be the ones who make it. That's the Americans. Urge your representative or your U.S. senator to buy American when it comes to buying defense equipment. This is going to be a tough contest, and we hope that people really get on the line and let their senators and their representatives know how they feel about this one. This is a lot of jobs.
Congressman Duncan Hunter, thanks for being on the Savage Nation.
Hey, listen, it was good being on with you, and thanks a lot, and we'll see you soon.
You know, people are trying to silence Michael Savage. That's me. I need your help. It's a big battle, a legal battle. The opposition has unlimited funds. I don't. Will you please go to michaelsavage.com, contribute $5, $10, $1,000, $10,000. You'll notice that you can contribute to the Legal Defense Fund under a new address. The mail goes to the Michael Savage. That's if a check, a money order, cash. Michael Savage Legal Fund, 4 Embarcadero Center, 39th floor, San Francisco 94111. Thank you for helping protect freedom of speech. Michael Savage Legal Fund, 4 Embarcadero Center, 39th floor, San Francisco 94111. And God bless you for helping protect
Savage
freedom of speech. America is still reeling from the Wall Street bailout as a result of the burnout of Bear Stearns. Wilson Berman is the pen name for the New York City investment professional who's written an article for the American Conservative about the Bear Stearns bailout plan and the effect that such a move will have. Wilson Berman, welcome to the Savage Nation.
Hi, Michael. Thank you very much for having me on the show. I appreciate it.
Well, what really happened? What caused Bear Stearns to blow out?
What happened to Bear Stearns was linked to that bursting of the housing bubble. For the past couple of years, this was a firm that was a major player in the subprime market, subprime real estate market. When that market started to unravel last summer, Bear Stearns was caught holding a lot of that bad paper, and in a lot of cases, that paper was worthless. This past March, things really started to come to a head, and that was when rumors started flying around about the firm's solvency. Now, if you're a firm on Wall Street and there are rumors out going around about your firm's solvency, that's not a good thing. These firms depend on clients and counterparties for business, for everyday business. Clients are basically large customers, hedge funds, mutual funds. Counterparties, on the other hand, are Wall Street firms that a company trades with every day. So in the case of Bear Stearns, that would have been firms like Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, Morgan Stanley. So what happens is when either clients or counterparties, or in some cases both, which is what happened here, when they start to have doubts about a firm they do business with, what happens is they'll pull their money out from that firm or they'll simply stop trading with it. And for a medium-sized firm like Bear Stearns that had a fairly undiversified business, that's really the kiss of death. And that's pretty much what happened in mid-March, and that was when the Fed stepped in to stop the firm from declaring bankruptcy.
Well, you said that this isn't really a bailout. Why isn't it?
I think that really depends on what your definition of a bailout is. Is it company gets in trouble, government writes check, company lives happily ever after? If it is, that's not what really happened here. I think you have to keep in mind Bear Stearns barely lasted a full trading day between the Fed's involvement and the news of the takeover by J.P. Morgan. So I don't think that qualifies as a classic sustaining bailout that keeps the company going until better times come around. What this really was the government stepping in using public money to grease a deal in the private sector. I think it's important to keep in mind, you know, a year ago, Bear Stearns stock was trading at $150, and this deal with J.P. Morgan happened at $10 a share. Now, say you're a Bear Stearns employee, you own a couple thousand shares of your company's stock. Yes, there's obviously a huge difference between getting $10 a share for that stock and getting nothing, which is what would have happened in the case of bankruptcy. But I think the fact is that most Bear Stearns employees who were invested in their own firm took a pretty big hit from, you know, 6 months ago or a year ago. And I think also, you know, I think it's worth keeping in mind that also right now there are a lot of resumes. There are thousands of resumes floating around Wall Street from former Bear Stearns employees. So I think if this was a classic bailout in the sense that most people understand that word, it would probably be news to those employees who are out there with their resumes.
You do a lot of business on Wall Street. In your opinion, is this a good or a bad thing?
Well, I think there's a trade-off there. In a very narrow sense, did this work? Did it work when the Fed stepped in to stop the bankruptcy? I think the answer there is yes. It was a bad situation, stopped a bad situation from getting a lot worse. I mean, you know, if Bear Stearns had declared bankruptcy on a Sunday night, Monday morning people would have turned on their TV screens and seen the stock market down probably 10%. So was it good to avoid that? Sure. But, you know, like everything else, especially on Wall Street, there's no free lunch. Cost of gas and everything else is going up because of this. And I think another problem with this deal was the precedent it set for something similar to happen in the future. Bear Stearns was a medium-sized firm. It wasn't a commercial bank, didn't carry any public deposits or checking accounts. So for the government to use public money to help a firm like that, that basically created an implicit guarantee behind a whole bunch of other Wall Street firms that are larger and in a lot of cases more important, Goldman Sachs, Merrill Lynch, obviously J.P. Morgan. These are firms that now have a sort of unstated guarantee behind them, similar to, you know, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, that if anything happens in the future, the government will be there with public money, just like it was for Bear Stearns. The government's not going to let any of these larger firms go out of business. They made that clear with this deal.
Well, is this something the government should be doing?
I think to answer that, you have to think about how much this deal costs beyond the actual $29 billion that the Fed Fed backstopped the deal with. I think that goes back to last summer. I mean, when all this trouble started in the subprime market last summer, what happened was the Fed started injecting a huge amount of money into the financial system. It lowered interest rates very, very quickly, and it also massively increased the amount of money it injected into the banking system. That's been great for Wall Street firms. A lot of them, if you look at their stocks over the past couple of weeks, that these stocks have started to recover pretty much from all this liquidity that the Federal Reserve injected into the banking system. But that hasn't been so great for everyone else. I mean, if you look, as an example, in early February, about a month before this news started, the Bear Stearns news, oil was trading at around $87 a barrel. And when things really started to go south for Bear Stearns and other Wall Street firms in February, what happened was the Fed really started rapidly increasing the amount of liquidity in the financial system. By the time we got to mid-March and the Bear Stearns episode, oil had gone from $87 in February to about $110 in mid-March, and it still hasn't come down. I mean, you can look at it now, it looks like it's heading for 120 and then maybe higher. So I think in that sense, every time your listeners go to fill up at the gas pump or they go to the grocery store, they should be thinking about what the government is doing to help these large Wall Street firms and the effect that has on inflation and the cost of living. And I mean, there's a definite link there.
How long will we be feeling the effects of this, and what's the final cost going to be?
Yeah, I think the inflationary cost is ultimately the cost that matters. I mean, the Fed backstopped the deal with $29 billion of public money. Depending on how the collateral that was made, that it was Bear Stearns collateral that was part of the deal, depending on the final price for that, you know, I think the final cost, just, you know, in tangible terms, will be around $29 billion, you know, maybe more, maybe a little less. But you really, that's you know, that's just one part of the cost. You really have to keep in mind what the Fed is doing to facilitate that sort of deal, which was really prime the financial markets with a huge amount of liquidity, and the impact that has on gas and groceries and doctor's bills and tuition and insurance and, you know, highway tolls and furniture and clothing. I mean, all this is related. I mean, the way the Fed has greased the market for this sort of deal to make sure that these companies don't, these large firms, these investment firms don't go under, is to basically throw a huge amount of money. And that's why you see the dollar getting destroyed and you see the price of gold skyrocketing and everyone realizes it when they go to the gas pump.
Do you think this will happen again, or was this a one-time deal?
You know, could this happen again? You know, sure, I think it could happen again. After this, there's what I think is an implicit government guarantee behind any firm that's larger and more important than Bear Stearns, and there's certainly a lot of them. You know, it reminds me of in the 1920s, Calvin Coolidge said the business of America is business. Well, right now, I think the business of America right now, I think, is Wall Street. I mean, that's the raison d'etre of this, of the government and the economy right now. You know, I think a lot, I think some of your listeners or most of your listeners probably know some people right now who were having their own versions of Bear Stearns. They're going through a tough time with mortgage payments, price of gas, and everything else. But I don't know how many of your listeners have a good idea of, you know, what's behind firms like Bear Stearns. Who are the people who work at these firms who are benefiting from this sort of policy? So here's an example. I have a friend. I've got a friend who works at a firm that is a direct competitor to Bear Stearns. He's a guy in his early 40s. And until about 5 years ago, he was getting paid about $1 million a year, which is certainly great by almost anybody's standards. But during the past 5 years, he's made probably between $3 and $5 million a year. Now, someone has the same job, same responsibilities. He works at the same firm as 5 years ago, but because he has a job that's been related to the Fed's monetary policy, he's made a huge amount of money during the past few years. And I think what's important to realize is he's not alone. There are thousands of others like my friend all over Wall Street, some of them making less and some of them certainly making a lot more. If they work at firms that are at least as important as Bear Stearns was, then the effect of that deal is they know they have public money behind them if times get tough. I mean, if things really hit the fan, the people who work at these firms know that the Fed and the government will not let these firms go under. That's based on the precedent that the Bear Stearns deal set. So if you think about it in terms of that, which is essentially socialization of risk and how everyone pays for that, you know, when they shop, they go to the gas pump, or they go to the grocery store, I think that's an important part of this. You know, I've never been a fan of the liberals, you know, class warfare platform, rich versus poor, that whole thing. But I'll tell you, if Republicans are going to back these sorts of deals, especially during a recession, then I think there are going to be some very serious consequences of that, short and long term. So I think that's something worth thinking about and worth watching.
Yeah, but should the government be in the business of bailing these companies out? It seems as though it takes a lot of the risk out for these companies for making very bad choices.
I think it does. I mean, I think there's certainly a case for they keep the profits and everyone else shares in the losses. But I think it's really worth thinking about in terms of the long-term cost, about the implicit government guarantee, one, and two, the effect on inflation. I mean, everyone pays for this, and I think everyone is going to keep paying for it unless, you know, we get some change in policy, either from a new administration or a new Federal Reserve chairman.
Wilson Berman, thanks for being on the Savage Nation.
Thank you very much for having me on. It was a lot of fun, and maybe I can do it again.
Savage.
Now, I want to go back to the big story of the last few weeks, which is this, and you must pay attention. Let us say you are a minority. Let's say you're a religious person. And let us say a neighbor doesn't like you and they call the police and they say there's abuse going on in your church, your synagogue, or your gate. There's abuse going on in your house and you've adopted children. And it's a false claim. And yet, without a sworn affidavit, they raid your house. Then they take children away. Now, they raid your house wearing body armor. They have machine guns. They have an armored personnel carrier outside your synagogue or your church or your house, let's say. And the police come in and with the mean face, clipped-haired women from Auschwitz, the guards from Auschwitz, looking on and smirking and thinking what they're going to get to do to your children, they take the children away, and then they conduct medical exams on the children without the parents being present. You'd say that can't happen here. But it is happening here. It's happening here primarily because of the leprechaun on Fox News. And I would say the number one psychotic in this entire incident is Nancy Grace, in my opinion. She's absolutely insane. If you were to ask me who was the worst and most evil person in the media fanning the flames of hatred against the people in the polygamy cult, it would be this psychotic, ugly woman with the craziest eyes in the history of the media who should be taken and put into Creedmoor for what she has done, not only in this case but in so many other, like a ghoul, like a vulture, whipping up a frenzy of hatred against these poor people. That's all one man's opinion, by the way. But let me summarize again. The threat was made by a woman, and it was false. One-sided information force-fed to the media via Fox News and CNN. It's readily swallowed by the gullible people in America in Gulliver's Travels. The false threat is not found, but the children are taken away from their parents. The babies are ripped out of their mother's arms while goons with machine guns look on. And none of the mothers were armed. And nobody in America says a word about it in the media except Michael Savage. That's the world you're living in. Instead, we're talking about people who eat Philly cheesesteaks in Pennsylvania. Now I'm going to take your calls. KNEW, San Francisco, welcome to the Savage Nation. What's on your mind?
Hi.
Yes, go ahead, please. We have very little time.
On the show, you were talking before about the religious Jew taken off the plane with his two friends.
Yes,
I was
sir.
One of the two friends, and we came a little late to the flight, so me and my friends started praying in the boarding area, and they boarded the plane really quickly. So
right.
The man that was taken off the plane didn't have enough time to finish praying before he got on the plane. He then got on the plane and went straight to the back, all the way, you know, where they have all the food waiting on the side. He started praying. And this prayer, you know, it's called Amidah. It takes around 1 to 3 minutes, and you're not allowed to stop in the middle. So he started praying, and, you know, before he knew it, the boarding was over. And, you know, around the minute into his praying, you know, the stewardesses were telling him he has to stop. So he went over, we told him that, you know, it's going to take 2 minutes, but he can't stop. That's what he explained to them. And basically most of the stewardesses didn't have an issue besides one that was, like, being really tough and insisting, you know, that he had to be taken off the plane because it was an FDA violation, meaning that he didn't.
Yes, but it was an FDA violation. That was my point. If you start to bend the rules of safety in the air – for one religious group, you have to bend them for all. Now, what if tomorrow or the next day we wake up and a group of Muslims say that they have to pray to Mecca and they prevent the plane from taking off? You'd find objection to that?
Well, he didn't really mean to us.
It doesn't matter what he meant. We cannot, for the safety of all the passengers and for the system itself, you cannot permit a religious group to start to dictate safety rules on an airplane. Why couldn't he pray after the plane took off? Let me ask you that, Shlomi.
Because he already started and he didn't have enough time to finish.
Why didn't he wait till the plane took off instead of starting before it took off?
Because he figured he had enough time. It just they finished.
But he made a mistake. He figured wrong. So then the whole world can't spin around his miscalculation, can it?
I guess not, but the FDA violation that they claim was a problem is that he didn't listen to a stewardess. In other words,
okay, but wait a minute. Didn't we have a case about a year ago of the flying imams, the Muslims who went on the plane, and the opinion of many people who studied this, they did this on purpose. They got up during a flight. They asked for seatbelt extensions when even though they were thin, some of them, things of that nature. Didn't we find that odd behavior? And then they went ahead and sued the airline based upon the fact that they said their religious freedoms were violated. We cannot have every religion on earth saying this is my religion and I'll do it my way when we have an air transportation system that is quite tense to begin with and running under very, very difficult rules. That doesn't mean that I'm against prayer on airplanes, Shlomi, but I think you have to see the bigger picture, don't you?
I understand. I think that the violation was that, in other words, they were scared he wouldn't listen if they'd have some sort of emergency, and that clearly was not a problem. That's what the way they.
Well, it wasn't a problem in that case, but it would have set a precedent. Once we enter an airplane, well, in fact, once we enter an airport, we give up our civil rights, and once we do, we enter a police state where there's absolute authority by people who normally we wouldn't associate with. We turn our personal dignity over to people working for minimum wage who get the right to strip search us if they desire without due process. Is that right? It's wrong. But we all do it because that's the system that's in place. I don't like it. I hate it. I don't like associating with people who I normally wouldn't associate with, who then have the power of virtually life and death over me. Remember the case of over a year ago of a woman who went crazy at an airport and wound up dead because the thugs wound up shackling her to a wild animal instead of treating her like a sick person. The thugs at Phoenix Airport shackled her in a back room, and she strangled herself to death out of fear of the poor woman. Do you remember that case?
Yeah.
It's terrible. I mean, flying today is not freedom. It's slavery. But getting back to the main issue, I'm in favor of prayer on airplanes. I'm just not in favor of people doing it at any time that they wish, particularly when the flight attendants are under very, very difficult regulations themselves. If they did not enforce the regulations, they could wind up losing their job on top of it all. Thanks for the call. I don't think I made a friend here, but I hope I didn't make an enemy. I'll split the difference. This is the Savage Nation. We've been talking about many different topics. This is only one of them. Again, the big issue, of course, is the Hillary Obama thing. I'm glad she won for a number of reasons. One, if it came down to a decision between Hillary and the tofu messiah, I would guarantee you I would take the comeback id, as I call her. You have to understand Freud to get the joke. But Obama is an untested, unproven fantasy. With Hillary, we know what we'd get, the pluses and the minuses. I'm saying between the two of them. So I'm very glad she's still in the race. The people who don't want this to go on are the diehard radical left-wing atheists like the media people. They're desperate to see the tofu messiah win for their own reasons, primarily because they see him as more in sympathy, you know. They're more in sympathy with the radical left-wing like they are. This just came up on the Drudge Report. Walmart has limited rice purchases. I told you we're going to have a food hoarding in America. I told you that George Bush, who was increasingly bizarre and out of touch with reality, should impose export controls on wheat and rice and the staples in this country. But instead, we'll get the same dunce dance that free trade is good for America, while people wind up on food lines and perhaps starving in certain quarters. Just as McCain is out of touch with reality, as far as I'm concerned, going to Youngstown, Ohio yesterday in front of a factory that was practically closed and saying to the poor factory workers, free trade has been good for America. I can't imagine a more tone-deaf person than the Republicans. And frankly, I don't see any difference between McCain and Bush, if you want to know the truth, other than McCain actually flew an airplane in the war. That's about the only difference between the two of them. But right now, we'll leave it hang. With God's will and your listenership, I shall return.
Savage.